Lone Broadcast Center. This is Take 2. Me, Martinez. The cost of California cannabis will get higher on New Year's Day, with unlicensed shops consistently grabbing the lion's share of pot profits. Will the tax hike be the final nail in the coffin for the legal cannabis biz? Plus, flying out of LAX can be time-consuming, but there is another option right behind the Hollywood sign that the local in-the-know travelers swear by. Hear all about it ahead on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us this Tuesday before Thanksgiving, and we have a lot of good stuff for you today. Coming up, a new tax hitting cannabis companies next year could send more customers to the black market. That's ahead on the show. And what might be SoCal's best-kept airport secret hides just behind the Hollywood sign. Take 2's Leo Duran got the inside look. We're going to start, though, in Santa Barbara with the latest on the Kay fire burning there. So far, it's scorched over 4,200 acres in Santa Barbara County. 600 firefighters are on the scene. The fire is 0% contained.
Not surprised with all the fires, but I think everybody's always surprised when it's in your neighborhood.
That's Gwen Coxon, who lives near the fire. And here with the latest is Lance Orozco, news director at KCLU, NPR station in Santa Barbara and Ventura. Lance, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Hey, how you doing?
Good, good. Now, what are the conditions out to where you are right now?
Well, you know what? We are seeing a big change in the conditions from what we had last night. I mean, it was windy, not actually as powerful as some of the winds we had earlier this month, but it was enough to blow this fire out of control. It's still seeing 30 to 45 mile an hour winds. Been a little gustier in some spots. And the problem is the fire was burning in the mountains above Santa Barbara, so it was really hard for firefighters to get to it. And they couldn't use air tankers because it was night by the time the fire really got going.
You know, we always throw around the word 0% contained, 10% contained. What does that mean?
Well, it's a good question because people, a lot of times, they hear that, and I'm not sure that they know what it means. And it basically, it's firefighters are building literally a line around the fire. They're basically, you know, putting some kind of a barrier. They're actually putting a gap in there so the fire can't spread. And so when they say a fire is 50% contained, basically they'll say that we built line around 50% of the fire, and they get to 100% containment. And then there's a difference between containment and control. Once they get it fully contained, they still have to control it. And usually when they say a fire is fully controlled, at that point it's usually out.
Now how many people have been evacuated so far from this cave fire, how are they dealing with it?
Well, two questions there. The first one, about 5,000 people were evacuated. I talked to Sheriff Bill Brown about an hour and a half ago, and they lifted evacuation orders for part of Goleta at noon today. 4,000 of the 5,000 people actually were able to go home. But that last 1,000, they may not get to go home for a couple of days because those are some of the folks who live up in the foothills and mountains where the fire really hit. And some of those houses that I was up at earlier this morning and last night, the fire literally burned around them, but firefighters were able to keep the flames from actually destroying them. No homes destroyed, which is pretty remarkable if you saw this fire. It would be hard to believe that they didn't lose houses in the process.
Yeah, but if they're going to be out a couple of days, that puts it right there on Thanksgiving. I mean, there's no good time for this to happen, but man, what a time for it to happen.
Well, yes. I mean, the timing of it's bad, and then what makes it more difficult is this fire burned along Highway 154, and I think a lot of people in Southern California know it, as the road that connects Santa Barbara and the Santa Ynez Valley. You know, that's the place where they did the movie Sideways. It's wine country. And so that road is kind of a shortcut if you're headed up the coast to San Luis Obispo or the Bay Area. And with that closed, it means you're going to have to take Highway 101, a little bit further drive, and they're afraid that we're going to see some mudslides. It's a two-lane road that goes through the mountains, and so we're going to probably see some mudslides when that storm comes through tomorrow.
All right, that's Lance Orozco, news director at KCLU, NPR station in Santa Barbara and Ventura. Lance, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, moving on. State taxes on legal cannabis will go up starting next year, despite outcry from some industry leaders. The California Department of Tax and Fee Administration, or CDTFA, partially based the increase on inflation. But critics say the timing is inconvenient, with untaxed illegal marijuana sales far outpacing the legal market. CDTFA Director Nick Maduros joins us now to help explain the tax. Nick, welcome to Take 2.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, so let's start by focusing on your department. How did you decide to increase taxes?
Well, we don't set any tax rates. The tax rates were set in Prop 64, which the voters of California passed in November of 2016. And they set a rate of 15% on the gross receipts or the retail selling price of cannabis. And that 15% excise tax rate remains unchanged. Because of the way the legislature designed the tax, we are responsible every 6 months for figuring out the statewide markup rate, the difference between the wholesale price and the retail price.
So the actual taxation part is out of your hands in a way.
The tax rate is totally out of our hands. That was passed by the voters. The legislature and the governor could revisit that, but we just administer.
Now, what type of cannabis tax is being increased next year and by how much?
Well, so there are three taxes on cannabis, really. There's an excise tax, and there's a cultivation tax, and then there's the standard sales and use tax. There are two that are going up. The cultivation tax is pegged to inflation. The law requires us, starting January 1st of next year, to reset that for the first time. We just look at what the California Consumer Price Index has done, and we adjust for inflation. So that's going up by 4.349%. The excise tax is shifting from 60% to 80%, but let me explain that for a minute. So if a distributor is selling to a retailer a product for $10, the tax previously was 15% of $16, which is the wholesale cost plus the 60% markup. So it's 15% of $16. Now the tax will be 15% of $18 on that same wholesale transaction.
Now, some industry leaders, Nick, will claim that the increase is going to further push consumers to the illegal market, where some estimates say spending is 3 to 1. Was that a concern, something your department took into account at all?
It certainly is a concern of ours. We're also very concerned about the illegal market, and I'm certainly sympathetic. The law does not allow us to take those factors into account. We're simply administering the law as written.
So this is something that no one can say to you, Nick, why are you doing this? Is this something that needs to go up to Governor Gavin Newsom?
People are certainly saying that, but there's nothing I can do about it. And I can't say I'm surprised that this is generating so much controversy, but our role here is truly very ministerial and administrative, and it's really rather...
It's clinical, right?
It's like clinical. Yeah. It's pretty boring, frankly. So how it's become this drama-filled is news to me. But if people are uncomfortable with the tax rate, that's certainly something that the legislature and the governor can address.
That's Nick Maduros, Director of the California Department of Tax and Fee Administration. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
All right, now let's turn to one of those cannabis industry leaders. Jared Kylo is president of the United Cannabis Business Association. Jared, welcome to Take Two.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Now, you've had some idea this tax increase was coming. What's your reaction now that it's almost here?
I think when we look at increasing taxes right now with the amount of taxes we're already paying, it seems very premature to increase instead of decrease. So my thing is like maybe we need to look at the inputs and the metrics that went into evaluating this tax and take into account like an overall implication of taxes and what it's doing to an industry so we can start to assess, are there profits being derived from these companies? And if there are profits, are they extraordinary or are they minimal? And if you're looking at minimal, then we might want to look at the industry as a whole instead of just myopically focusing on what is the wholesale and retail prices.
Yeah, we spoke to their director, Nick Maduros, and he said that for them, it's a very clinical thing. They've got these numbers that they have to basically deal with and come up with another number, that if there's an issue, talk to their boss, Governor Gavin Newsom. Is that where you'd be going for this?
Yeah, I mean, we're on the same page. I mean, it's, you know, they're an agency doing their job and their job was very clear and they were given these are the inputs. So, yes, it does have to go to your boss. So it isn't necessarily just on Nick Maduros's shoulders, but there's a number in there that they're not including, and that's federal taxes. This is a shared responsibility from the state and the people inside the industry to either inform the federal government that they're overstepping their bounds of taxation or to reduce our taxes inside the state so that we can compete. And if we just have this mandate and we just keep following down this one path that says, you know, this is what we decided 2 years ago, then we're missing out on the opportunity to learn from our mistakes, see where the future is going and allow there to be a better path? And how are we going to compete with an illicit market that has much lower pricing? We have to do something in there to be competitive.
When it comes to a customer moving from the licensed market to the unlicensed market, I mean, the state's legal cannabis market could hit $3.1 billion in sales, but the unlicensed market is about to reach $8.7 billion. Does it all come down to taxes, Jared, or is there maybe other reasons driving people to that illegal market?
I think we had 25 years of Prop 215, which created a very mature supply chain. And then when you come in with regulations and you try to peel off some of those people who are in that mature supply chain, for one, there wasn't a lot of incentives to come into this taxed industry. There wasn't a lot of transitional time. And when you looked at the barriers to entry, the barriers to entry were so high.
When it comes to the tax increase, wondering if you've heard from consumers about this tax increase, and if at this point you're worried about losing customers.
I lose customers every day. And when you look at the reviews online for like Yelp and stuff, you know, I was 4.97 stars for 5 years until legalization happened. Now all of my consumers are complaining about pricing, complaining. That's really the only complaint I get now as a retail business. They think the retailer is taking advantage of the situation in the system, where the reality is the taxation is so high. And so the consumer is definitely, you know, voting with their dollars, saying, I'm sorry, but I can't frequent your place as much as I used to. Sometimes I'll come in here just for the medical needs that I have. But if I just need a joint, I'm going to have an illegal place deliver it to me because it's half price.
That's Jared Kylo, president of the United Cannabis Business Association. Jared, thanks a lot.
Appreciate it. Thank you much.
Nearly 200,000 Southern California Edison customers were blacked out in the past 2 months, some for days at a time. These public safety shutoffs are supposed to reduce the danger that power lines could start new fires, but they also mean that many rural residents lose more than just their electricity. KPCC's Chair McNeary has more.
The spurs on Amy Nelson's riding boots clink as she walks to the corral to see her family's horses. Motley, her palomito, slurps water from a barrel.
Good boy, Motley. He loves attention, though, if you hadn't noticed.
The Nelson six horses and two mules have plenty of water now, but their small ranch went dry 3 times in October and November when Southern California Edison cut power to Acton and Agua Dulce, north of L.A. Like most everybody around here, she gets water from a well, and that well needs an electric pump. It's in a little shack. Nelson climbs a ladder 12 feet up to the top of her 4,000-gallon water tank and lifts the lid so I can hear it fill.
When we have no power, there's no water pumping. And we get a little bit of trickle, gravity feed, but not enough to take a shower, hardly enough to flush a toilet.
And certainly not enough to defend her home or horses from fire, which is a constant danger here. In fact, the day before the first power outage, a car caught fire on Highway 14 close to their hay barn.
The tires were popping and the fire was spreading to the hillside.
For that fire, her husband Steve had access to a good water supply.
So he was able to put that out before the fire department even got here.
But the next day, during a windstorm, Edison cut the power. The Nelsons hauled out a used generator they'd bought years ago, but it didn't work. So they not only had no lights, they had no water to fight a fire.
It sounded like it could be really isolating without the power here.
Yes, especially when you don't have cell service because all the towers are out.
That's right. Without electricity, the phones don't work. The local cell phone tower's backup batteries run out. Gas-powered generators to keep the cell towers operating run down too after a few hours. So when Edison cuts the power, the Nelson's lifelines to water, internet, and phone service are cut as well.
We can't contact friends or neighbors or family, and everybody's wondering what's going on, and they're trying to tell us if there's a fire near us or checking to see if we're okay.
Residents of Acton and Agua Dulce in northern L.A. County have had standing room only meetings to confront Edison officials over the outages. Some residents talked about forming their own local power company or creating micro power grids. Some call the shutoffs the CYA outages, as in cover your ass. Amy Nelson agrees.
They say it's for safety, But I think it's more so that they don't get into trouble. It's the self-preservation and the trying to keep themselves from losing money.
The company's agreed to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in recent fire losses, and it's bracing for more when lawsuits go to trial. Edison Senior Vice President Phil Harrington acknowledges the outages burden residents.
We are very conscious of the impact that they have on our customers and our communities. We do not take it lightly.
At a hearing of state lawmakers, he said Edison will cover some customer losses, like spoiled food and medicine, for those who did not get the proper notice of outages. But the company says it's really the responsibility of the public to plan for blackouts and make their own arrangements to avoid losses. Amy and Steve Nelson say they're now prepared. They finally got their generator working during the area's third power outage in late October. That's when a new fire broke out near their home. As embers rained down, Steve had to drag the heavy generator they were using at their home uphill to the water tank so he could use their fire hose. Local firefighters soon put out the fire, but it was a bad scare.
He went straight to the store that day and got another generator so that he wouldn't have to unplug from the house and then drag it up here in the event of a fire.
But they're still looking to Edison to work with telecom companies to keep their phones working and internet on. Covering infrastructure, I'm Sharon McNary.
On KPCC this month, familiar voices are reading amendments to the Constitution. You'll hear LeVar Burton on the amendment that ended slavery and Roxane Gay on a citizen's right to vote. Plus, there's artist Shepard Fairey, actor Peter Sagal, and many more. It's all part of the nationwide Purple Project for Democracy, a nonpartisan campaign to recommit to democratic values and institutions.
Hi, I'm Danny Trejo. Your public radio station is celebrating our democracy by presenting the amendments to the Constitution that lay out our freedom and how democracy works. The Sixth Amendment was ratified in 1791 as part of the Bill of Rights, and it covers the rights of people accused of a crime. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. One of the reasons the Sixth Amendment is so important is that law enforcement could just lock you up. The minute you are arrested, the clock is ticking. First of all, they have to get you to court within 72 hours. You know, they can't just hold you. And if not, they just have to kick you out. So basically, if somebody has a piss against you, they can't just take it out and put you in jail. Wait, why am I in jail? Let me call my lawyer. So to me, that's one of the most important amendments we have, that and illegal search and seizure. That's another one.
That's actor Danny Trejo reciting the Sixth Amendment, part of the campaign Purple Project for Democracy. All right, my childhood and teenage years were spent in and defined by Koreatown. Now, as an adult, it's really been all about, as Gary Owens used to call it, beautiful downtown Burbank. I've lived there 25 years, kind of in the perfect spot. Just over the hill is Hollywood, Glendale, Pasadena to the east. As I said, kind of a perfect spot. So is Burbank's airport. Find out why it's been getting so much love lately over LAX when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Last week, more than 100 workers at the Museum of Contemporary Art, headquartered in downtown LA, announced their intent to unionize. It comes on the heels of a similar movement at the Museum of Tolerance, which successfully unionized last year. Then there was the effort to form a union at Marciano Art Foundation in Mid-City, which was announced a few weeks ago, but shortly after that, the operators of the Free Museum announced it would close indefinitely due to low attendance. Well, it turns out there's a national movement for museum workers to unionize. It's also happening in places such as New York and Seattle. To find out why and why now, we have Catherine Wagley, reporter for ArtNet News. Catherine, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now, is there a common theme to what museum employees are asking for? Something that maybe gives us insight about how they think they're treated?
They're all asking for more job security and better wages and a seat at the table in terms of determining how things are run. Part of the culture of museum work is that it's sort of a privilege to work in these spaces. Mm. You're doing something for the culture and you're also working with these beautiful, important cultural objects. Workers are starting to say, wait, is it though? Shouldn't we still be treated fairly? And something that was really interesting as I talked to this group, Art and Museum Transparency, who became known as a collective when they launched this salary spreadsheet that went viral in May, inviting people to list their museum work, art museum work salaries. Mm-hmm. And they said that the museum world has been pushing to make its workplaces more diverse, to represent more diverse artists and also have more diverse curatorial staff. And in doing that, they're pulling from a different field than they've previously pulled from. And if you're going to have more diversity in the workplace, you're going to have people from different class situations and different backgrounds who can't necessarily afford to live at these low wages. Whereas before, some people might have spouses or families that could help them.
Now, what has sparked this most recent movement? Because I know it's pretty rare in the country for a museum to have a union. MoMA New York, that's the Museum of Modern Art, one of the few, and that's been around since 1970. So what's been the spark for this most recent one?
It's a lot of things. I think there's been a lot of talk in the last few years within the art world about accountability. The museum world often has some of the wealthiest people in the country and the world are on these boards. So there's been a lot more scrutiny in the art world of that wealth gap that's represented by these museums. Why are there minimum wage workers in these institutions that should ideally be able to pay fairer wages?
And partly this started 2 years ago at MoMA specifically. What happened there in MoMA, New York City?
Well, MoMA started its union in 1970-71, and in May 2018, they staged a strike for better wages and ended up ratifying a new contract. And I think that's when, at least within the art museum world, talk about unions began to spark up again.
What are some of the other notable museums in the country where workers are trying to unionize?
The Guggenheim Museum in New York is currently in contract negotiations. The Frye Museum in Seattle is also forming a union. The New Museum in New York ratified its contract on October 2nd of this year. So that's a handful of art museums right now, in addition to the Marciano Art Foundation and MoCA in Los Angeles.
We're talking to Catherine Wagley, reporter for ArtNet News. What's the level of coordination and collaboration between the workers at these different places?
Well, that's something I was really interested in and wanted to better understand. And I think a lot of these movements are happening in parallel. Like at the Marciano Art Foundation, some of the visitor service associates began talking about unionizing as long as 2 years ago. But when the new museum announced in January, Marciano Art Foundation Visitor Service Association members got in touch with new museum organizing committee and had been in conversation from January until when the Marciano Art Foundation announced a few weeks ago. Similar things were happening at other museums. The new museum got in touch with MoMA when they wanted to organize. The Guggenheim talked to some art handlers at PS1. So I think that's something that's really interesting, is that these things are not happening in isolation in any way, that the people who are organizing are in conversation with each other and are paying attention to what one another are doing.
Now, we mentioned Marciano Art Foundation that's here in LA closed indefinitely. They didn't directly say it was because of the unionizing effort, but how else have museum operators responded to these movements?
Pretty much across the board, museum administrations have said when their workers announce that they want to form a union, that this is not the best thing for them. The new museum said that it would affect their special culture. The Guggenheim director, Richard Armstrong, said something about not wanting plumbing and auto worker people deciding what was happening in his museum. MoCA said something similar about not thinking this was the best for their employees.
Now, when it comes to the artists that have their work displayed in these museums, what kind of involvement has there been from them?
Well, I know that when the new museum hired a union-busting law firm to help them navigate their employees' wish to unionize, some artists who were in the new museum collection wrote a letter asking them not to do this, not to respond this way. And there's an artist who was in the Marciano Art Foundation's collection who tweeted support on Instagram. So I think there is, at least in informal ways, artists who are in the collections of these museums or are associated with them, siding with the with the workers. Actually, I know the New Museum had a whole campaign where people would say, I support the New Museum on Instagram. And many of them were artists who work at other museums or who are represented by the New Museum and other major collections.
Now, I know we're entering the holiday season. That's a time when kids are out of school, people are out of work, and we're maybe going to a museum with family is a good way to spend some quality time. But what should we as patrons know about museums and their employees the next time we head to one?
I know that when the New Museum was on strike, I talked to some people who said they weren't going because they wouldn't cross a picket line. But I think it's always good to remember that these are people who need protections as much as anybody else does, and that they're doing this job. Many of them are also highly skilled and knowledgeable about the work they're interacting with. And it's good to remember, when we're working with service employees and we know to tip because we understand their work conditions, it's good to remember that these people are highly knowledgeable. Often, many of them have advanced degrees, but they're often working for relatively low wages.
Catherine Wagley, reporter for ArtNet News. Catherine, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
During the course of this Thanksgiving holiday, over 3.2 million travelers are going to be passing through the terminals of LAX, one of the busiest airports in the country. Now, some people might get headaches from that, while others might say a headache is normal for traveling through LAX. However, KPCC's Leo Duran looks into another airport in the area that may be smaller but has big fans.
On the plus side, LAX is a portal to the world. On the other hand, it can be a pain to get in and out of.
It is not good today.
That's passenger Merrick MacArthur, who was waiting a long time with Peggy Warney on the first day the airport debuted its new system for rideshare pickups.
I think we'll call a friend and make them do the terrible thing that you never have your friend do, is pick you up at LAX, because this is really sucky.
Recent reports say the congestion is better, but even before that went down, publications like Fodor's Travel said that the traffic patterns were so bad in general that that's the main reason they rated LAX the worst airport in the world.
Look, when we say it's Dante's Inferno, it's not literally the worst place in the entire world.
That's Fodor's editor, Jeremy Tarr.
But you get stuck in this awful, really vile horseshoe pattern, and then you just sit there and you wait.
On the other hand, Tarr says the country's best airport is just downwind, Hollywood Burbank.
It's like an old school, what it used to be to travel. It's just, you show up, not a lot of hassle, easy to get around, and you're on the plane now.
It's completely unscientific, but I commonly hear from friends who say that if they had a choice, Burbank all the way. That's what passenger Jennifer Bolt said as she corralled her twin toddlers before their recent flight out of Burbank.
Security is easier. It's not as congested. Traffic is easier. Parking is easier. Picking up bags is easier. So just the whole process of flying Burbank versus LAX is easier.
So from drop-off to takeoff, I wanted to know the other secrets of the little airport that could. I met up on the curb with its marketing director, Narissa Sugars, who says, look,
you know, I wouldn't call it a rivalry.
That's because Burbank doesn't have the same kind of passengers. LAX does international flights, for example. Burbank doesn't. So it has the benefit of being small.
We had last year just over 5 million passengers come through.
By comparison, LAX had almost 17 times that in the same period. So LAX is like the 405 of airports. But with fewer people, getting through traffic and security at Burbank can be a breeze.
It's all about convenience. You can get dropped off at the curb and get your gate in 12 minutes. Well, that's my average.
Now, before you step into the terminal, take a look up on top of the building. It's a control tower, except it's not.
We don't operate out of it. We actually have a different control tower.
You can see the real traffic control tower out the window across the runways. That's one secret. Burbank's runways are special, because there's no other airport in the country where the terminal is this close to them. Actually, it's too close.
This building is within 200 feet of the center line of the runway.
That's the head of Burbank Airport, Frank Miller.
You'll see the airplane coming in and how close it is as it passes the concourse.
According to the FAA, buildings need to be at least 750 feet away from a runway. But since this is one of the oldest airports in the country, it was built in the 1930s, it's been grandfathered in. Back in the terminal of Hollywood Burbank Airport, Narissa Sugars took me to the only tribute to its former name.
So this is a bas-relief of Bob Hope. It's probably the only thing right now that
tells us that this is Bob Hope Airport.
Some people say they missed the name when it changed 3 years ago. It was done because of marketing. Sugar says calling it Hollywood Burbank makes it easier for out-of-towners to know that this place is actually close to Los Angeles. Although here's a secret, Bob Hope is still its official name.
So legally, with the FAA, we are registered as Bob Hope Airport still.
We keep walking through the airport, and when you're there too, keep your ears open and listen in.
So frequently it's 80s music, either that or 70s rock.
Yeah, if you think there's some airport science about what kind of music passengers want to hear.
We have our IT folks who have access to the satellite radio subscriptions. They just randomly pick whatever music we're going to hear for the day.
Finally, once you're at the gate, ready to board, there's one more thing that makes places like Burbank pretty rare and unique in the country. Boarding by walking directly onto the tarmac.
See, we see a lot of people taking pictures. And they'll do the selfies when they get up the ramp, the air stairs.
Most other airports have a jet bridge, where passengers take an elevated tunnel directly to their plane. One reason is that a jet bridge protects people from the elements year-round. But because of Southern California's temperate climate, Sugar says passengers in Burbank think stepping outside is part of the airport's charm. It's old school.
There's something about being out in the open, and they're in LA, and it's always warm and sunny, and there is that feeling like it is kind of glamorous.
There is something new school on the horizon. The airport is building a modernized terminal on the other side of the runway. But community members said they loved boarding by walking onto the tarmac. They explicitly said, please, keep things that way. So the airport's president, Frank Miller, says, we'll do.
That's the plan right now.
But once that new building debuts in 2024, something about the experience will change about going to Hollywood Burbank. This current beige building we just got a tour of will be no more. Remember, by federal regulations, it's too close to the runway.
And it's tough. I mean, it is part of the history, but it has to come down. I mean, the whole, it's just not safe.
So you'll just have a few more years to enjoy this timeless, classic building of Los Angeles. Even if, when you go through, you don't spend that much time there. For Take Two, I'm Leo Duran.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away. If you can use...
All right, now, corporations all over the world have been assigned a big part of the blame when it comes to climate change. The idea is that the drive for profits outweighs protecting natural resources. So, what to do now? How about letting capitalism save the planet? Hear that argument next on Take Two. All right, we have lots of news all day long here on 89.3 KPCC. And during All Things Considered, Nick Roman is the host. He will fill you in. Nick, what do you got to this afternoon?
Well, we're going to have updates on the cave fire in the hills above Santa Barbara. It's still 4,100 acres, no containment. They got 21 phone calls in the first minute of that fire after folks started calling in. So they had a lot of folks that were last night. We saw that fire go from 30 acres to 3,000 acres in about 6 hours. We'll also talk with KPCC Sharon McNary about mudflow prep as the big storm rolls into Southern California. And by the way, chance of rain tomorrow, 100%. And we'll tell you how the emergency room bill to treat a little kid who got a couple of tiny doll shoes stuck in her nose ballooned to $3,000. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So when they say the parts aren't good for they're not kidding about that.
Yeah, the little girl's okay, but the parents are a little steamed about $3,000 ER bill.
All right, that's Nick Roman with All Things Considered coming up this afternoon. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. When it comes to global warming, capitalism is often seen as the problem. The relentless need for corporate profits, many believe, is at odds with our natural environment. But a new book seeks to challenge that idea, arguing that capitalism might actually be the solution. Joining me now is Andrew McAfee. He's the principal research scientist at MIT and the author of More From Less, The Surprising Story of How We Learn to Prosper Using Fewer Resources and What Happens Next. Andrew, welcome to Take Two.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, Andrew, in your book, you argue that the way to stop damaging the planet isn't to reduce consumption or to recycle and reuse. You say the solution is to grow more technologically sophisticated economies around the world, and a lot of people are going to hear that and completely disagree, Andrew. So what's your top line argument?
And I understand why they disagree, because it sounds crazy at first. The combination of capitalism and tech progress is exactly what caused us to take more from the earth, to pollute the earth, to do all these things throughout the industrial era. So I'm making this very weird argument that now the reverse is happening. And I do that by showing the evidence. But the reason why it's happening is that we have this amazing new toolkit called computers and networks and artificial intelligence and all that, that lets us trim all the things that we spend money on, all the materials, lets us make smartphones instead of camcorders, lets us make aluminum cans that are as thin as possible. And all those resource savings line up. So now we're in the period where we continue to grow. We continue to have capitalism. It continues to be voracious. But when you keep in mind that a penny saved is a penny earned, and this digital toolkit allows us to save all over the economy on resources, which cost money, the drive to make money is also a drive to save money. And now we're in the point where the savings is dominating.
So the desire to be more efficient and spend less on production, you're saying that that eventually will get us to where all of us want to go.
That's exactly right. And that desire, it's correct. Capitalism is this voracious profit-seeking thing. But as soon as you realize that things cost money and that really thirsty capitalists want to reduce their spending and save all that money, and we have these great technologies now that let us accomplish that savings, then your worldview starts to flip around. And it's not that capitalism solves all of our problems, but it does solve the problem of taking more from the earth. Now we know how to take less.
In your role as principal research scientist at MIT, you study how digital technologies are changing business, the economy, and society. What digital technologies of the past few years have had the biggest effects on society, either for good or for the bad?
For me, the biggest change that's going on is the fact that artificial intelligence is finally keeping all of its promises, the ones it's been making for over half a century, and even exceeding them. So we have not yet begun to see all the ways that AI and machine learning are going to help us improve our productivity, save on resource use, economize on energy, all of these things.
Talking to Andrew McAfee, he's a principal research scientist at MIT. His book is called More from Less. Now, as we speak right now, fires are burning throughout California. Glaciers are melting faster than scientists have expected. Climate change clearly is here, and a lot of people would probably argue against the premise of your book, Andrew. They'd say that capitalism is actually causing all this. So what's your response to that?
They are absolutely right about that. Global warming is real and it's bad, and we're not doing enough to stop it. And these productive activities that we engage in all over the world, they are causing greenhouse gases. Absolutely. The argument that I make in More from Less is not that capitalism alone will solve all of our problems, but when you combine capitalism with a people who demand change from their governments and governments who listen to their people, one of the great triumphs of the environmental movement was the victory over pollution. We demanded cleaner air. We got it via really smart policies. So when I think about the problem that way, greenhouse gases are a very difficult kind of pollution to fix, but they're not impossible. They're not mysterious. And the instant I start thinking about greenhouse gases as a particularly tough kind of air pollution, the solutions become a lot more obvious to me, and the problem becomes a lot easier to think about.
But can capitalism move fast enough for what scientists say is something that is looming actually a lot quicker than anyone anticipated?
The right way to activate capitalism is to make greenhouse gases expensive. And we have lots of ways to do that. We've done that with previous kinds of pollution. I'm a big fan of a carbon dividend, which is a tax that gets rebated to all the people in a society. And the thing to keep in mind is the instant you change a business's cost structure, it will run away from those increased costs like a gazelle runs away when it smells a lion. We'll be amazed at how much innovation, how much new activity there is to save on those carbon costs once carbon actually costs something. Now, again, I'm not saying it's trivial or it's going to be easy or the taxes aren't going to be serious. And so far, we've lacked the political will to do it. The problem is difficult, but the point I make in the book is it's not mysterious.
Now, you argue in More from Less that the U.S. is polluting the air and water less, but the Trump administration has been rolling back environmental protections. Have things changed since the time your book was published and the institution of these new policy changes?
Yeah, unfortunately, I just saw a story the other day that air pollution levels in the United States have risen substantially since 2006. And the decades of progress that we made to reduce air pollution levels, they are now reversing, and we're now polluting the air more. How much more? The study said that the increase we've seen since 2006 could probably cause about 10,000 additional early deaths. That's a big number. In fact, it is almost certainly bigger than the number of additional deaths from the Chernobyl nuclear accident. Air pollution is deadly, deadly serious news. We need to keep being vigilant and fighting against it. So the fact that we've seen a rise in the past couple of years is incredibly bad news in my view.
Over the last year, multiple Asian countries have stopped taking recycling from the U.S., but you don't think that we should even bother recycling single-use plastics. Why isn't recycling worth it, in your opinion?
The benefits of recycling, when you listen to the arguments, fall into three categories. Number one, they help us save on scarce resources. Number two, they help us reduce greenhouse gases. And number three, disposing of trash is a really serious problem, so recycling it is better. None of those three arguments work very well for plastics. The hydrocarbons that generate plastics are just not scarce in the world, especially since the fracking revolution. The carbon benefits from recycling plastic are actually really, really low. Very little of the carbon benefits of our overall recycling come from plastics. Most of them come from paper. And then finally, that third argument that recycling is better than just landfilling our trash, I think that's dead flat wrong. What's been happening with plastics recycling is we ship hundreds of thousands of containers of our plastic trash overseas to low-income Asian countries to recycle it, and they do it in these environmentally really unfriendly ways. That's the only real mechanism by which American plastic trash ends up in the world's oceans is if we try to recycle it via Asia first. I think that's an environmental catastrophe, and it needs to stop.
So what role do governments have to play then to make sure everyone is heading toward a more sustainable direction?
The role of government is to deal with the bad side effects or the bad consequences of capitalism. And for me, when I think about the environment, there are two of those. Number one is what we were just talking about. It's pollution. It's particulate pollution in the air. It's greenhouse gases. It's polluting the rivers and the oceans. Government needs to put in place measures to stop that kind of stuff. And the other one is what we've seen, unfortunately, is if we let animals like the bison and the blue whale become inputs to production, they will be, and we can drive those animals to the brink of extinction or beyond. So the other great triumph of people who demand change and governments who act is to say, you can't hunt blue whales anymore. There's a global moratorium on that. We're going to have hunting seasons for a lot of the other animals to give them a chance to replenish themselves. We take care of those two big problems, pollution and dealing with our fellow creatures, and then I think we've dealt with a lot of the environmental problems that free markets bring up.
Andrew McAfee is a principal research scientist at MIT, and he's also the author of More From Less, The Surprising Story of How We Learn to Prosper Using Fewer Resources and What Happens Next. Andrew, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Hey, it's been fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Up next on Take Two, a story on a haiku. Stay tuned, it's Take Two. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. All right, you know haiku, that poetry form you learned in school? Three lines. First line is five syllables. Second line is seven. Third line is five. Well, for over 20 years, a small but persistent group of writers has gathered at libraries, museums, and picnic tables across Southern California to write and study the ancient Japanese poetry form. The Southern California Haiku Study Group was formed in the late 1990s by a Cal State Long Beach math teacher named Jerry Ball. In August, Ball passed away in Northern California, but the haiku study group he founded lives on. Take Two contributor Matt Hoisch recently went to the group's monthly meeting at the Hill Avenue Branch Library in Pasadena, where members were remembering him by reading some of his many poems.
Pollen on his nose. He tells me the camellia has no fragrance.
Green tomatoes. He tells his grandson about patience.
Everyone is quiet when the man with Parkinson's tries to speak.
Mm-hmm. The way home from work.
End of a long day.
Geranium.
Relax. Time to come.
summer twilight at the edge of the open sidewalk.
I see what it is.
There is brightness.
Autumn mist. Not quite raining, but thinking about it.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi, it's Matt, the radio journalist.
Oh, yes, hi. One moment.
It's Matt, the radio journalist. Did you want to speak
to me? Hi, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing, Debbie?
I'm fine. Can you hear me okay? Yes. Can you hear me okay? Yeah. Okay. My name is Deborah Picolosi. I'm a haiku poet. I am the moderator of the Southern California Haiku Study Group.
Cherry Ball is kind of one of the reasons that I do what I do. When I first came to the Haiku Study Group, my very first time, I didn't know much about haiku. I hadn't read enough. You know, I just do the kind of stereotypes. And so Cherry really opened a window for me to a world that has totally influenced my life. Because when I write haiku, I notice things more. And it's not that haiku is a religion or anything silly like that. It's just that it's a power of observation, training.
My name is Naya, and I'm a member of the Southern California Haiku Study Group, and I'm co-founder and moderator of Haiku San Diego. He started up Haiku Study Group in, very late in 1997, and I joined sometime about a year later. So I've known Jerry since that time, and I couldn't have asked for a better mentor. When Jerry founded the group, he named it Southern California Haiku Study Group. And he always reminded us that the study in there is so that none of us assume that there are masters in the group, that there are such learned folks in the group that we're too intimidated to speak up. He said, if whether you've been writing haiku for a year or 50 years, you're always studying and you're always learning haiku. I did print a couple out here. Now, this is probably technically not the best, but this shows some of what this kind of things he might observe. Then she smiles again. It's a real problem being pretty. All this quiet. Birch branches have captured the twilight. Dust settles. A desert road is lonely again. Oh, here's the last one I'll read you. How like a dream. Tonight, I am a spider in a web of stars. Probably the one I like the most of the ones I wrote you. I read to you. My name is Sandy Ball, and I'm Jerry Ball's wife, and we were married for 37 years. My sister and I went to see The Lion King just take a little break from everything, you know, paperwork and stuff after somebody passes away. It's not fun. So it was a nice break last night. I wasn't ever really part of the haiku group, but just being around him, I became really involved, and especially the last couple of years because he wasn't able to drive and because of his Parkinson's, he couldn't do a whole lot. So I was with him all the time. So I would be taking him down to the haiku group. He carried a little notebook in his pocket always. And wherever we were, he would, if he saw something that spoke to him, he would write it in there. And lots of times he wouldn't share it with me because he didn't feel like it had been fully formed in his mind yet. I would see something and oh, that's nice. But he would write something so much deeper about whatever it was. For example, when we got a dog, we would walk her on walks and stuff like that. And she, you know, she would be sniffing around. And, you know, it's just walking a dog. But to him, it was like he would write a haiku about how, gosh, I wish I could think of it exactly. But the way he would phrase it would just be so amazing. He would say, our little dog sniffing the grass, checking her messages, you know, something like that. He can talk to little kids. He can talk to adults. He can talk to any age in between. He could. And he would just mesmerize them. he would come talk to my third graders, and you could hear a pin drop in the classroom. He would show them a little Japanese, and he would show them what a haiku was, and he'd show them how they were pictures, and he would then write a little bit and get them to write a little bit, and they were just mesmerized.
There is one a detail that Debbie mentioned, and I really just kind of wanted to get your perspective on, just because it seemed, I don't know, it struck me. Were you playing opera during his last few hours? She mentioned that he was an opera lover and that you were playing opera.
Oh, we were playing classical music. I had classical music playing 24/7 because he loved it, including opera, but it was classical music. Mozart, Beethoven was by far his top one, but Mozart. He loved Rossini for operas, Verdi. Beethoven 7th. I'll tell you, Beethoven 7th is his favorite.
I mean, the trick of the trade, there's a very high probability that some sort of classical music will make its way into this piece, just because, I mean, it's a really beautiful image.
Okay.
But, yeah, that was there.
That would mean a lot to him if you played that in that piece. I'm sure he would pick up on it.
That was Sandy Ball talking about her husband, Jerry, founder of the Southern California Haiku Study Group, who died earlier this year. And just in case you were counting syllables during that piece and realize that most of those haikus weren't that 5-7-5 form we learned in school, well, it turns out that the syllables you count in English for haiku aren't equal to the sounds that you would count in Japanese. So in English, you don't worry about syllables so much. Pro tip from Jerry, just try for a short, long, short line pattern. That piece was produced by Take-Two contributor Matt Hoisch with music from Humpei Asai. All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.